Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, October 9, 2013. A new poll shows a new low. Public perceptions of members of Congress.
All my friends, the low rider.
They're riding way low.
The low rider is a little higher.
And I would suggest it's driven largely by knuckle-dragging Republicans whose wrists hang pretty low already. Yes, a new poll shows that only 5% of Americans approve of the way that Congress is doing its job. Now, to be fair, that's a lot of Republicans who hate Democrats and a lot of Democrats who don't like Republicans. But this is a low watermark for public approval of Congress, and it's well-deserved. I doubt if you can ever get to a zero rating, because there are just too many people who will always say that their member is doing what they want, and therefore it's okay. But 62% of people in the same survey blame Republicans for the current government shutdown and the stalemate over lifting the debt ceiling. And in the same poll by Associated Press and GFK, whoever that is, 37% say they approve of the job that President Obama is doing. But when I look at the real underlying cause of this, and we discussed the New York Times' great investigative piece from this past Sunday that showed that former Reagan Justice, he was the Attorney General, Edwin Meese, started this whole thing on the night of Obama's inauguration for the second term. Millions of dollars were committed by the Koch brothers, by other friendly plutocrats. And fundamentally, it is the poison, the toxic nature of money in our political system that drives so much of this. The Tea Party people who are funded by the Kochs and others sit in safe seats protected by Republican state legislatures and governors through gerrymandering. They're virtually untouchable except by the very wealthy who threaten to run an even more Neanderthal individual against them if they break ranks. And so the power of that money holds the Tea Party radicals in place. It neutralizes Republicans who pass for the term moderate, and that's a real stretch in so many cases. But moderate these days are people who didn't really want to shut down the government, but went along with Speaker Boehner out of party loyalty and the threat that the Koch brothers and other political operatives will take them out at the next election. And yesterday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the McCutcheon case, another bad case coming from the depths of Alabama. Sean McCutcheon is a Republican activist and apparently has deep pockets because he feels that he can't exercise his free speech rights when he's limited to donating a mere $123,000 to political candidates in a 2-year cycle. And it's pretty clear that the same justices who backed Citizens United, in fact, who rewrote the case before them so that they could blow off the limits and allow corporate spending to occur on an unlimited basis, these are the people who believe that rich people should be able to spend as much as they want because their money is the same as speech. Of course, it makes their speech louder than the rest of us, but apparently those five justices have hearing issues. So the McCutcheon case is one to watch, but it is likely that in time for the next elections that even more money, mostly coming from wealthy right-wing interests, will be flowing into political campaigns of almost every sort. Well, speaking of contributions, I like to thank the people who support my work here. You're not buying political influence, but you are supporting an independent voice in an increasingly bought and paid for media landscape. Cheryl Fleming is a monthly subscriber, so is Jeff Lipinski, Rolf N., no name, no last name, please, and Teresa Paris. and I'm very grateful for their support. Would you like to join them? Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Under my picture in the upper left-hand corner, you'll follow the links to sign up. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. I've got bonus books. The new one is Spying on Democracy by Heidi Boghossian. And I have a limited number of those books to give away to new annual subscribers. You also get a bag of that kick-ass Kona coffee, lovingly grown by Russ Archibald and his friends on the Big Island of Hawaii. The other way you can support us? Well, steer your web business to GoDaddy.com. Right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rates at GoDaddy start at just $1.99 a month. Can you believe that? And they'll give you your domain name free. To get a screaming deal that also supports the Peter B. Collins Show, just follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast at good old peterbcollins.com. Well, the good news is Larry Summers is not the choice of President Obama to be the head of the Federal Reserve Bank for the next 5 years, starting in January. He has announced that Janet Yellen, from right across the bay at the University of California, Berkeley, a longtime economist and the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, will be moving up to replace Ben Bernanke. And you'll be hearing a lot about this. As it goes, Janet Yellen is more liberal than most of the people who have preceded her at the Federal Reserve. It's a real plus that she's not Larry Summers. I know I already said that, but it's worth saying again. But, and she's the first woman to head the Fed. That's nice. But remember, President Obama campaigned on change we can believe in. And Janet Yellen is simply moving up. And while she has advocated slightly more liberal policies under Bernanke, she is a creature of the Fed. And it would be nice to see Obama appoint an outsider to one of these agencies. His appointments have always been very safe. They lean Republican. They lean to people who created messes that an agency or an entity is supposed to clean up. And so, yes, it's a relief that Summers is not the choice, but there will be no meaningful change at the Fed. And that, of course, is what the patrons of Obama from Wall Street want. And he is delivering once again. From time to time, our NSA whistleblowers talk about the massive storage facility, the server farm or data center, that's being built in Bluffdale, Utah, south of Salt Lake City. And it's interesting because the Wall Street Journal, a reliable echo chamber for official government sources, often cloaked in anonymity, reports that they're having big problems at the Spook Center at Bluffdale. Chronic electrical surges have destroyed hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of machinery and delayed the center's opening for a year. Now, I want to be very clear about what I'm about to say. It is pure speculation. I've made this up. But when I read about this, it reminded me of what we have done to Iran's nuclear facilities with Stuxnet. Yes, we have this virus, this malware, that we were able to insert into the Iranian nuclear networks. And it causes the centrifuges to break down, crash, and basically self-destruct. There have been 10 meltdowns. I'm returning to reality now, by the way. There have been 10 meltdowns in the past 13 months in Bluffdale. They say that the electrical failures occur as a flash of lightning inside a 2x2 box, creating fiery explosions, melting metal, causing circuits to fail. And when that happens, what becomes of the intercepted phone conversations of innocent Americans that have been collected by the NSA? I don't know. And I find this very interesting because, well, let me put it this way. Most of the NSA whistleblowers I have talked to say that Bluffdale has been operating for some time, maybe even over a year. And here we're told that it's unable to get up to operational speed because of these electrical setbacks. This is a million-square-foot facility, bigger than anything that Google has. They tell us it cost $1.4 billion, not including the supercomputers that they'll install there. Interestingly, James Bamford has flatly told us that the facility is big enough that it can collect information in quantities measured in yodabytes. And a yodabyte is really, 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 really fucking big, okay? That's all I can tell you. But here in the Wall Street Journal, it says that estimates are that it will keep exabytes or zettabytes. An exabyte is roughly 100,000 times the size of the printed material in the Library of Congress. A zettabyte is 1,000 times larger. And again, I don't know exactly what a yodabyte is. Uses lots of juice there, 65 megawatts. That's a power bill of $1 million a month. The journal also acknowledges that the data centers operated by the NSA include a new $900 million facility at Fort Meade, the headquarters in Maryland, and a smaller one in San Antonio, Texas, which a separate source has indicated to me used to be a telephone assembly plant for the Sony Corporation. The story goes on. The backup generators have failed numerous times. There are disagreements among government officials about the adequacy of the electrical control systems. You'd think these spooks, when they get a chance to build their dream palace, would get it right. But we're told that there have been at least a dozen of these incidents, and it's not clear that they have the situation under control. As you may know, I'm a son of the Buckeye State, and I'm glad I don't live there in Ohio anymore. The New York Times updates us on the impact of the draconian rules that were imposed via a very weird process legislatively. They attached new abortion regulations to the budget bill. And part of the reason is the budget bill cannot be subject to a voter referendum. And that's what activists in Ohio did when John Kasich, the current governor, a Republican, former Fox News contributor, former congressman, initially took office and tried to turn Ohio into a right-to-work state. I think it was called Senate Bill 5. And activists went to the polls and repealed that sucker. But that's not available for the abortion rules that were imposed via the budget process. They require an ultrasound of the fetus. The pregnant woman is forced to watch the heartbeat of the fetus and then wait 24 hours. And Ohio, according to this story in the Times, has become a prime laboratory for what anti-abortion leaders call the incremental strategy, passing rules designed to push the hazy boundaries of Supreme Court guidelines without flagrantly violating them. And one right-to-lifer, a pro-birther named Mike Ganadakis, the president of Ohio Right to Life, says, we've been able to craft pro-life laws that can withstand court scrutiny. So that's their strategy. They know that they can't directly outlaw it, and so they don't push, like other states have, to narrow the abortion window to the first 20 weeks. So it's quite an insidious process, and it's working. Chris France, the executive director of a nonprofit abortion clinic in Cleveland, says they say they're doing this to protect women's health, but some of the laws are actually harmful and some are just cruel. These rules include that a woman seeking an abortion has to be told the probable odds that her pregnancy would go full term. There's been a diversion of federal welfare money to so-called crisis pregnancy centers, new financing for rape crisis centers on the condition that they provide no abortion referrals. I guess those are legitimate rape crisis centers. And the tightening of parental consent requirements for minors. Then, of course, to avoid passing money to Planned Parenthood, the state ended competitive bidding for family planning grants. And the other thing that they've done is this rule that an abortion clinic has to have a referral agreement with a local hospital, you know, in case a problem arises, complications. Now, that seems fair and, you know, reasonable on the face of it. But at the same time, they passed a law that prohibits public hospitals from becoming referral agents for abortion clinics. What does that leave? A handful of private hospitals, mostly operated by Catholic religious orders. And so, once again, the door to abortion clinics are being slammed shut by legal maneuvering that skirts just below violating the Roe versus Wade, constitutional precedent. We've discussed the last few days the American military raids in Somalia and Libya over the weekend, and questions continue about both. The one in Tripoli, Libya, where we grabbed an alleged Al-Qaeda leader, we're now told was conducted with tacit approval of the Libyan government. Last night on the public television news hour, I give Jeffrey Brown credit. He tried to ask tough questions of a robotic White House counterterrorism advisor named Lisa Monaco. But she was programmed to just repeat her talking points without answering most of the questions that he posed. And John Kerry has done something similar, the Secretary of State, where they spin this up that we have this wonderful relationship with this barely functioning government in Libya, and they allow us to Bigfoot them when we can enter there and take out a terrorist. Now, the embarrassing part of this, of course, is that Republicans who are still obsessed with Benghazi correctly point out that we haven't attempted a raid to get people they think are responsible for the attack on the facility in Benghazi who are hiding in plain sight in Libya. And some argue that if we were going to violate the sovereignty of Libya to grab this Al-Qaeda guy, we should have gotten the Benghazi guy at the same time. Now, as you know, I don't have much stomach for the Republican focus on Benghazi. I think there was a cover-up. They smelled the cover-up. They tried to exploit it for political reasons during the height of the campaign season last year. But I believe the cover-up was because it was a CIA base and they were running guns to Syria. And Obama wasn't about to say that in the middle of the re-election campaign. And so they fed Susan Rice those bad talking points and tried to pretend that this was an attack that was in response to that bad video. You remember the story. But the Obama administration's got to get its story straight. And I believe that we cause more trouble than we solve or, you know, fix when we engage in these cowboy military maneuvers in countries where we have no legitimate business being. The Obama administration is planning to suspend some of American military aid to Egypt following the deadly crackdown. 50 people died in recent days. But the administration, and I don't oppose this move. I think they should actually be tougher on the military junta, which conducted a coup on July 3rd, and here we are, July, August, September, October. We're 4 months later. And even though they're planning to cut off aid, it's not in response to the military coup. We cannot hear an official in Washington utter the words military coup in the same sentence with Egypt. And unfortunately, our policy is being, what's the right term here? I wouldn't say controlled, but unduly influenced by the State of Israel and Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu. They want us to keep giving money to the military rulers in Egypt to try to maintain whatever balance they have on the border and in the Sinai Peninsula. And once again, we allow Israel to exert way too much influence on American foreign policy. Steve Horn is at it again, another great report at dsmogblog.com. I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast. He's focused on Anita Dunn, a top Obama campaign advisor who is now, and former White House communications director, who's now on the payroll of TransCanada. And according to Steve Horn, she has helped craft the ethical oil deceptive public relations campaign. And they are running ads and on TV and radio in markets across the country and in the Washington, D.C. area. I haven't heard the spots or seen them, but it's quoted here, America imports millions of barrels of oil from the Middle East every week. But we don't have to. Ah, so this is the energy independence card that they're playing. And it overlooks the fact that we just passed Russia to become the largest single oil producer in the world, in part due to fracking and offshore drilling that have been championed by this Obama administration. Not only does Anita Dunn have the TransCanada account at her PR shop, but her husband is Bob Bauer, the president's personal attorney, the guy who was counsel to his election campaigns in 08 and last year. The guy he put on the committee with Ben Ginsburg, the Republican legal beagle, to try to fix only one aspect of our broken election system, and that is to keep people from waiting in lines in certain states. So, you know, the fix is in. And I'm trying to think of a gimmick here. Maybe I would agree to drink some crude oil. Not a lot, but a little. If Obama ultimately rejects the Keystone XL pipeline. Well, the president didn't go to Bali for the conference. In fact, he canceled his entire Asian tour this week because of the government shutdown. John Kerry is there, and I've been to Bali. It's a beautiful island. I'd love to go back sometime. But they are there to continue what are called the Doha round of trade talks and promote the Trans-Pacific Partnership, one of the worst trade deals that we have seen. And, of course, the negotiations largely being conducted in secret. And it's interesting, I saw an Associated Press story last week about this conference in Bali. And you know how in an article, before they use an acronym, they spell it out completely, right? That's the first reference spelled out completely, and then the second one they'll use the initials, and everybody understands how that works. Well, in this AP article, they referenced the World Trade Organization, and then WTO showed up several times. And then in the last paragraph, there was just one reference to the TPP without ever having introduced it as a subject in the article. Now, it may have just been bad editing at my local newspaper. But the Trans-Pacific Partnership is in large part a secret. And the negotiations are conducted out of the sight of any independent observers, our elected officials. Members of Congress are told they are not permitted to know what's going on in the TPP negotiations. And our friends at Public Citizen, including Lori Wallach, the director of their trade desk, have said that this is one of the worst deals. It's like NAFTA on steroids. And finally today, North Korea reportedly has restarted its nuclear reactor at Pyongyang. And this presages their desire. Oh, I got that wrong. It was at Yongbyon, which is north of Pyongyang. I know these are tricky names, and they trick me up every once in a while, too. And it's unclear what the motivation is. But it's more bad boy behavior from Kim Jong-un, who is the, what is he now, 29, maybe 30? The chubby boy who's running things over there. And we're going to have to watch him very carefully, see where all this leads. Hey, thanks for joining me today. This is my News and Comment podcast, and you are authorized to share it with absolutely anyone. I hope you will. Thank you so much.
Happy trails to you. until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until